From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, Gary Peters is making climate change an issue in his Senate campaign. Is that the best way to win in Michigan?
It's up to voters to decide whether or not it's a gamble, but I do think that it is an unusual choice.
One man's campaign to preserve Michigan's barns.
They tell the story of America, and so the barns in Michigan tell the Michigan component of that story.
A Michigan company helps vehicles switch to propane.
You're bringing your particulate matter, which is the black soot that comes out of the tailpipe that causes lung issues, to zero.
And the 300-year history of fur in Detroit.
They wanted to come here for a better life, but they had to survive, too. So they opened stores with the trade that they knew.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. A federal judge has given approval for the Detroit Police Department to get out from under more than a decade of federal oversight. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today on Stateside, who is now responsible for making sure past problems, excessive force, arresting and detaining witnesses will not ramp up again? Then, later in the hour, the 300-plus-year history of fur in Detroit. But first, it's a tight race for U.S. Senate. Democrat Gary Peters versus Republican Terry Lynn Land. It has become clear Congressman Peters has decided to make climate change one of the central issues of this campaign. Andrew Restuccia reported on the Peters Green theme for Politico. Welcome, Andrew.
Thanks for having me.
Well, as you note in your piece, this Rust Belt state is one of the last places you might expect to wage a winning Senate campaign by trumpeting climate change and boasting about voting for cap and trade. So why is Gary Peters doing this?
Yeah, I mean, it's really fascinating, actually. I mean, you are used to sort of very liberal Democrats in safe districts or states talking about climate change, but you don't often see it in such a tight race in a state like Michigan in particular. But I think Peters is looking at the polls, and he's truly trying to feel out people in the state. And for the first time in a while, he's a lawmaker who's decided that this is an issue that he thinks he can win on.
What are we seeing? How do you feel it's resonating? Because you do talk in your article about some voters, Democratic voters even, who are kind of reluctant to buy Peters' message that climate change is harming the Great Lakes.
Yeah, and I think that in general, the way to talk about climate change is almost to not talk about climate change, right? And you can apply some of the scientific evidence to things that really resonate with people. And, you know, the Great Lakes is obviously, and you know this better than I do, I'm sure, a huge economic driver in the state. And so he can sort of talk about climate change without alienating people by connecting it to things like the Great Lakes and connecting it to what happened to Detroit with the Petcoke there. And then kind of weaving a larger narrative about Terry Lynn Land and trying to make her seem outside the mainstream.
So give us some examples in more detail of how he has crafted his message to really hit home and matter to the people listening in Michigan.
Sure. I feel like he has several different climate change messages that he's been using. The first is sort of just outright, climate change is real, we need to deal with it, we can't hesitate, and it's good for the state. His argument is that it will create a whole new sort of industry based around renewable energy that, you know, will create jobs. And then the other side of it is sort of saying, I'm talking about climate change here, but my opponent, Terry Lynn Land, isn't. And this is symptomatic from his perspective of her ignoring some, you know, basic issues that need to be addressed. And he has very aggressively criticized her position on climate change and made the case that she's an extreme candidate. Now, you know, that's up to the voters to decide, obviously.
It's a big race with a lot at stake. Tell us what happened when you tried to talk to Terry Lynn Land about this.
Yeah, so I spent, I had been talking back and forth with Terry Lynn Land's campaign for quite some time before I went out to Michigan for the story. There was some talk about potentially being able to sit down with her to discuss, you know, energy and environmental issues in general and climate change in particular. And at the end of the day, they just weren't willing to make her available for an interview. And it's a criticism that Gary Peters' campaign just loves because, I mean, they like to sort of suggest that she isn't as available as he is. So at least in this instance, they were much more willing to talk about it than Land's campaign was.
Well, you actually wind up in your story in Politico, I get the sense you were trading emails with people to try to get some kind of a sense of her position.
Yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, what they settled on was that they would let me, you know, ask questions via email, and they would provide answers. But obviously, those answers are, you know, are sanitized to some degree, and it's not the sort of off-the-cuff remarks that you'd get in a one-on-one interview, which is, as a reporter, of course, very frustrating. And I think for it doesn't serve the reader quite as well either.
As you write, she wrote you back, and here's her quote, that there is no denying the climate is changing. We must take measures to protect the environment. But you weren't able to get a whole lot more than that.
Yeah, and you know, on an issue like this, it's important to ask about specific proposals that she has to deal with it. I mean, you know, she is certainly not what some people call a total skeptic or a denier on climate change. I mean, she's at least acknowledging that it's a problem. Now, the question is, you know, how serious of a problem is it from her perspective, and what does she want to do about it? And that requires a little bit more of an in-depth conversation.
Let's circle back to Gary Peters. Andrew, what kind of voters is he seeking out? I mean, it certainly doesn't seem like he's going to win over a lot of Republican hearts with this issue, but what about the undecideds?
Yeah, I think you have to be realistic about this, right? I mean, the people who you know, just really don't believe that climate change is an issue that needs to be addressed aren't probably going to be the people that are voting for Gary Peters to begin with. So he's really trying to win over, you know, Democrats and liberal Democrats, but also kind of people that are in the middle that have maybe a sense that this issue is percolating and could affect their bottom line. That could be anyone from a fisherman or a sports fisherman to a conservationist to someone that, you know, boats on the Great Lakes, you know, on the weekends. And these are really important voters for someone like Gary Peters.
Are we seeing other Democrats making this a campaign theme? I know Politico is doing series on how national policy issues are affecting the 2014 midterm elections. You wrote this story for this. Are we seeing this happening in other races around America?
Yeah, to some degree. I don't think quite as much as Peters is taking it on, but there are a number of Democrats around the country, particularly those that are in safe seats and aren't really at risk of losing, that are talking about climate change every day. And there are a few others that talk about it that are in tight races. Mark Udall in Colorado, the Democrat who is running for re-election to the Senate, is someone that talks about it quite a bit as well. But it's pretty rare at this point to make it the central focus of the campaign. And I don't think that necessarily climate change is the central focus, but it is certainly a focus. You know, Peters, as you know, talks about lots of other issues, too, so I don't want to oversell it.
Andrew, you point out in your piece that certainly climate change is a huge issue, but it does seem right now on the national front and certainly here in Michigan, more of the attention is focused on jobs, the economy nationally. We've got so many foreign crises. Is this a political gamble for Gary Peters?
I think, you know, I mean, it's up to voters to decide whether or not it's a gamble. But I do think that it is certainly an unusual choice in many ways, particularly, like you said, when jobs and the economy are at the forefront of everybody's mind. But I think Peters would argue that they're kind of inseparable issues, right? That climate change and jobs and the economy are all tied together. And at least that's the least message that he's trying to send. Now, whether people care about that enough to actually vote for him is an open question, I think.
Yeah, because as you write, is Peters offering a vision that could help other Democrats win tough races in manufacturing heavy states, or a cautionary tale? So really, we aren't going to know the answer until the morning after Election Day.
Exactly.
Andrew Restuccia's story for Politico is entitled One Democrat's Gamble on Climate Change, as we talk about Congressman Gary Peters. Andrew, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
When you see people who are homeless, especially young people, it can be real easy to make assumptions about their lives. At least that's what Robert Sporny says. And he says your assumptions about homeless youth are probably wrong. Sporny is a lawyer in Ann Arbor. As a baby, he was adopted, and childhood with his adopted family was difficult. There was alcoholism and abuse in the family. On the last day of high school at age 17, Sporny decided to permanently leave the situation.
And I got on my bicycle and basically rode all the way across town to a friend's house.
For a while, he slept at his friend's tree house. Eventually, he hooked up with Ozone House. It's a nonprofit that helps homeless and runaway youth. The organization helped him connect with a food program and other services. Overall, Sporny was homeless for 1 year.
And during that time, I hooked up with like these other homeless people. And you know, homeless people hang out together. And homeless young people look like they want to be homeless. You know, you look at them on the street and you think, well, you know, they seem to enjoy that lifestyle. You know, scrubby and dirty, and they seem to be having a good time sitting in the park, you know, just sitting around. But nobody who's an intelligent human being chooses that lifestyle unless there was something that had happened to them earlier in their life that made that lifestyle actually seem logical. I would say that what helped me the most during the time that I was homeless was when I was, it wasn't just the Ozone House, but there were the other social services, and it was those people who I had met, and I had not had a lot of contact outside the home growing up because of the alcoholic home. It was meeting those caring people who actually genuinely were giving of themselves. Well, honestly, at the time, it was just not believable. When you grow up in an alcoholic home and it's full of deceit and denial, and people are kind to you outside the home, you're actually suspicious. It took me many years and some counseling to learn to trust people, and I'm still working on developing that trust. 30 years ago, I was totally lost and had no idea what to do to try to. I had no idea how I was the way I was or why I was the way I was, and I had no map going forward. Today, you know, it doesn't go away. Your youth doesn't just dissipate. But today, I'm somebody who knows where to go for help, how to deal with it, how to work with it, and how to use it to help myself grow.
Robert Sporny is a lawyer in Ann Arbor. He has helped at-risk youth in juvenile court, and he speaks to organizations about his experience with homelessness. This story was produced by Michigan Radio's Kyle Norris. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. When the French built Fort Pontchartrain on the banks of the Detroit River in 1701, there was a very big reason why. Fur. The trappers who brought their pelts to the fort to trade gave Detroit its first industry. In the 300-plus years since, Detroit's fur industry has seen good times and bad, and it's still standing in 2014. Writer Josie Schneider tracks this history in her story for Our Detroit magazine. It's called Passion for Pelts. Welcome to Stateside, Josie.
Thank you so much.
So if beaver fur hats had not become the fashion rage in France in 1700, who knows where Detroit's history might have gone?
That's true. Louis XIV, the king of France at the time in the middle of the 17th century, was a very dandy dresser. And he stomped his purple high-heeled shoe and demanded that the beautiful beaver pelts come from across the water in the new land.
And here they were. And as you state in your piece, the fur industry literally formed the city of Detroit. How so?
That's right. Before Fort Pontchartrain was built, this was a wilderness. There was nothing. And so the folks who had been using the St. Lawrence Seaway for trade found this great spot where the river widened and built the fort there in part to house the fur trade.
And who was out there? We certainly know that the native tribes had been, you know, trapping furs for centuries. And then who was it, as far as Europeans, who spread throughout the New West to trap?
Well, they were pioneers that had first come to the East Coast and were moving westward little by little. And they were doing what they could do to survive. And the animals were abundant all around the Great Lakes and up into Canada. And so that whole system of waterways really helped them move their trade around.
So seriously, Detroit and Michigan were really built on fur pelts at the very beginning.
The very first birth of Detroit.
Now, you point to about the 1950s as the peak of Detroit's fur industry. So we're jumping way ahead, but it built through the 1920s. And you say there were more than 100 fur retailers by 1950 in the Detroit area?
I know, so many dotted all around, and they were mom-and-pop stores for the most part, from immigrants that had come in the wave of folks that came in the first part of the 20th century. And again, they were bringing with them the trade that they knew, from Europe, Russia, all over the world. And so they wanted to come here for a better life, but they had to survive too. So they opened stores with the trade that they knew. But the real aha moment for me in doing the research for this was that they didn't want their children to carry on in that trade. They thought of themselves as mere tailors. And they wanted their children to go to university and have careers and climb the ladder of success that they came here for, the American dream.
But what you found is, especially for the last three standing, right, we have Dietrich, Zrezjaninov, and Bricker-Tunis are really the last three big ones standing. But the kids came back, or the grandkids came back.
Right. And again, they're all of the owners who are now there had gone on to other careers. Hmm. Their parents had not encouraged them to stay in the business. But in the 60s, late 60s, 70s, and 80s, the fur business was booming. And sales tripled in that time for furs. People were enjoying new wealth in the Detroit area. And so those young entrepreneurs who their families had started the fur businesses came back in because they saw it as a great business to be in at the time.
Things were booming. And then, as you point out in your piece, October 1987, Black Monday, we saw the stock market take the largest one-day drop in Dow Jones history. And that really changed things.
That was the beginning of a downturn in many things, and especially in the fur industry. Black Monday, of course, had people's economics in mind. But then, of course, shortly after that, in 1990, in Aspen, Colorado, the mayor there started a referendum to ban fur in the city of Aspen. And even though that referendum never passed, it was really the foothold that the animal rights folks across the country were able to really get started in their whole movement that was the second punch to the fur industry. So things were really kind of crashing and burning for the fur industry then.
Because we saw this spread, as you say, across the country. And I can remember reading stories of people who were wearing furs on Fifth Avenue in New York and somebody come up and throw paint on it or slash it with a knife. And it was all trying to convince us to get away from wearing fur. And it's understandable. There's a sense among many that it's absolutely abhorrent that an animal dies so somebody can have a beautiful coat.
Right. And it was the picture of wealth as well. And so because of Black Monday, people were more cognizant of conspicuous consumption also. And that trend started too. And there are also stories of people who were embarrassed to be seen carrying a shopping bag that had, you know, a high-end label on the shopping bag. So there was all kinds of things coming together at that time, which really hurt the fur industry. And then the third punch, which still remains today, is that people dress casually. They
dress up.
You know, when I was a little girl, we wore white gloves to go to the airport. People don't go to the Rattlesnake Club or other fine establishments in their big fur coats or tuxedos. Everything is casual. Everything.
And at the same time, and I do remember this after the 70s and 80s, the rise in fake fur. You know, here's the animal-friendly option, you know, no animals involved. But the view of them today, you write, is somewhat changed.
Well, surprise, surprise, that because of the ecological green movement, people are looking at plastics again. And fake fur is basically a polyester plastic. And not only that, but polyester, for whatever it's used for, any kind of clothing, polyester is a product, a byproduct of petroleum production, which kind of gives it a bad name there too. So any kind of plastic, including fake fur, when it's thrown into a landfill, takes 50,000 years to deteriorate. Now, I can't corroborate that time frame, but that's what the scientists say, is that it would take that long for plastic to deteriorate.
So is there a move toward acceptability again of wearing animal fur?
Well, those vintage furs that may be in someone's closet or in the storage at a fur vault are coming out, and young designers are repurposing them, taking those furs, cutting them up, and using them to make new garments out of. And there is an annual competition held in Italy that is all furs. And they're part of the competition. The finale of it is called Pimp My Coat. And it's all about taking a fur, a vintage fur, and doing crazy, wild things with it to pimp the coat. And so this is getting designers excited about fur again.
What about animal welfare protesters? And did you talk to Detroit's furriers, the Detroit area furriers, about their thoughts about that?
Yes, and I think Glenn Ceresni said it best when he said that protesters have a constitutional right to free speech.
So nobody's forcing you to buy fur is what he's saying, but it's there. They are there.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So are we seeing our sales going up? Are they noticing an increase from the days in the 90s and the early 2000s?
It's mixed amongst those three furrier, the big ones that remain. There are other furriers in Detroit as well, and it's mixed. But in general, there is an uptick. And Ceresni and Offen in downtown Birmingham had one of their best years in a long time this year.
Very interesting. Josie Snyder's look at the 300-plus year legacy of Detroit's fur industry can be found in the September issue of Our Detroit magazine. It's called Passion for Pelts. Thanks so much for speaking with us, Josie.
My pleasure. Thank you.
When is an old structure worth saving? And when does that structure become something that's dangerous and needs to be torn down? Those questions are being asked with word that the city of Ann Arbor recently tore down a 19th century farmhouse and barn that it had purchased in 2003. Some might say it is ironic. The barn was located next to the city's recycling center. Architect Chuck Bullman is with the Michigan Barn Preservation Network and the National Barn Alliance. Chuck, tell us about this barn. How old was it?
Actually, I don't know much about this barn, and that's somewhat of the amazing part. I learned of this barn literally on the Monday morning that it was being torn down just from an article that I saw. The raising of the barn was put on in a consent agenda with City Council months earlier, and no one had focused on it. As a matter of fact, Dave Askins of the Chronicle, who I know attends every one of those meetings and is a friend and colleague of mine, I emailed him immediately and said, "What do you know?" And he said, "I didn't even know it was going away." I then emailed a number of city council, and they responded that they didn't know it was going away.
So it was very secret squirrel.
I don't know if I want to call it secret. I think it's an unfortunate aspect of the barn world that people might have this old building, and they might ask the opinion of someone who they think should know. And one of the things I've written about many times is that most architects, engineers, and builders are not qualified to comment. Original question, when is it time to tear down a barn? Well, unless you know timber framing, you shouldn't be asked, because they're difficult buildings to understand. They're very, very strong. And many times people look at them and, well, they're dirty. They're a little scary. And the one thing that is unfortunate is the safest answer is tear it down.
So as part of the Michigan Barn Preservation Network and the National Barn Alliance, both of them existing to preserve old barns, you have to feel really bad. I'm sure that this was so off the radar that you or the groups couldn't speak out in support of further study and take some time.
Right. And I'm not saying that the barns absolutely should have stayed. Mm-hmm. I just don't know. But I'm fairly certain that the majority of the people looking at it, they aren't qualified. And that's the thing. It comes down very quickly. I went by the site, you know, it was 24 hours into the demolition, and it was mostly gone. The components that I was seeing, they were perfectly viable. I've certainly used scarier barns and converted them to be other things.
What do you believe, because you're so committed and passionate about barns, and you're an architect, so you're looking at it from that perspective, what do these barns say about Michigan's history?
They say a lot about America's history, because I look at the barns as a sort of continuum of construction that came from the East as settlers came here and then as people pushed further and further west, and that they tell the story of America. And so the barns in Michigan tell the Michigan component of that story. you see gable barns, simple barns with two roof slopes. And the story in Michigan is that many of those barns were built in the early 1800s. But we do see a lot of gambrel roofs here, which is interesting, which is the four roof slopes. And nine times out of 10, I don't know, eight times out of 10, the gambrel barns we see are converted gable barns. And I like that part of the story. It reminds me that barns were constantly in flux. And so when they were originally built in the early 1800s, they would have been built with gable roofs. And then with the advent of certain inventions, the hay fork, the ability to get hay higher up in the building, they converted the roofs to store more hay. And that's sort of the Midwest, particularly Michigan's, component of a story that stretches from the Atlantic Ocean all the way into the Pacific.
And when a barn is torn down, at least without further study to see if it could be preserved, we're losing a chunk of that.
Yes, it is unfortunate. I mean, it is the plight of barns. You know, and this is across the country that there's a struggle to use barns for farming because farms are using bigger equipment and land's been subdivided and the issues that we hear about. So now you have...
And the small farms, the small family farms are fewer and fewer.
They're fewer and fewer. The good news there is they're actually growing a little bit. And there is a lot of talk of smaller acreage farms, 10 acres, 5 acres even, and they will need a barn. And while that will save some barns, I'm afraid it's not going to save them all because many of them are still in locations that, you know, they're in the middle of subdivisions or industrial parks.
Now, this barn was not listed in the State Historical Buildings Directory. Would that be step one for, first of all, an owner who wants to preserve or save an old structure?
That actually is a fine thing to do, but it's not really a necessity, nor is it something that guarantees the protection of the building. It's a great step to point out to the community at large that these are respected buildings. But in my opinion, using the barn is more important than just listing it on a register.
And what kind of uses, as you see barns around Michigan, what are some of the ways barns are being repurposed?
The repurposing in Michigan, what I hear most about is using them for things like event spaces and weddings. That's carrying a certain conversation that's going on across the state as to whether how that is done and whether that is appropriate and the techniques used for converting it. The building codes still apply to that, and the building code for wedding space and event space is dramatically more. I mean, for a barn, there is no building code. The state of Michigan exempts barns from the building code when they're used for agriculture.
And you're saying this is something that's actually drawn the attention of the state legislature.
It has, and it has drawn the attention of a number of organizations, including the American Institute of Architects, the National Barn Alliance, and the Michigan Barn Preservation Network, and other state organizations.
Chuck, what inspired your passion for barns? What and when?
Many years ago, I was asked to design a house with a barn, and I didn't quite know what I was getting myself into, but I've always been someone who really likes a challenge. One barn project led to another and then to another. I've really learned that the kinds of spaces that you can make with an old barn frame are very different and very beautiful than the kinds of spaces you can make with other kinds of architecture. When we use an old barn, there's a beautiful story to be told. Whether that story is that we took the barn down and moved it to another location and gave it another life because in its prior location, it was destined to be torn down. The typical reasons are neglect, insurance companies that won't insure them, new construction, industrial parks, roads, you know, barns get in their way. Those barns need to have something done with them, or they can have something done with them, so then we reuse them. There's other stories like where we get to take the barn down from the property, restore it, and bring it back to that property. And that's what we just recently did in Dexter. We learned the house that sat next to was built in 1834. And we dated the barn through a process called dendrochronology to 1837. That's when the timbers were cut. So it was built around that time. We know that it had been moved in 1894 to 1895 to a new foundation. So we took it down for the third time, for the second time, I should say. We restored it and brought it back. And it's now, it is in fact an event space.
So it continues to live.
So it continues to live.
Architect Chuck Bullman, who is with the Michigan Barn Preservation Network and the National Barn Alliance. Thanks for talking with us, Chuck.
Thank you.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. A federal judge has given approval for the Detroit Police Department to get out from under more than 10 years of federal oversight. The two federal consent judgments date back to 2003. They were imposed after allegations that Detroit police were subjecting citizens to excessive force, false arrests, illegal detentions. The DPD now reports that reforms have been made, fatal shootings and use of force rates are both way down. So the department now begins to transition out of federal oversight with an end date in 2016. Detroit Police Chief James Craig is with us now. Welcome back to Stateside, Chief.
Thank you.
What does this mean first for the Detroit Police Department?
It means it's a great day, but it doesn't mean that our work is over. Certainly, we want to continue to embrace and adopt the practices that we were held accountable to and will be held accountable.
And what does this mean for citizens in Detroit?
Well, it just is another layer of enhancing our credibility with the community. Just another signal that this department is about their business. We are the police department for the people. And certainly when you're a constitutional police agency, you know, people respond to that. One point that I think is key is when we look at our clearance rate. You know, when I got here now 14 months ago, lots of talk about an 11% clearance rate to homicide, and now we're averaging anywhere between 65-75% clearance rate throughout the year, which suggests that people talk to us, they have confidence in this police department, and because we're effective, we're exceeding the national average, which I think is 60% as it relates to clearance rates.
Yes, in fact, I know when we talked before, that's something that it's clear you're very proud of and justifiably so to see that go up. What are the numbers telling us, really, about fatal shootings, about average number of shootings, and the use of force rate?
I mean, we're down in comparison. You know what's interesting, and when I put it in the context of the work that Detroit police officers are doing today in comparison to 14 months ago, we're making many more contacts with the community. I mean, it's no surprise that we've conducted 9 large-scale operations in various neighborhoods throughout the city, some of the operation with 200 to 300 police officers involved in that work. And over the 9 operations where we've arrested a large number of people, we only had 1 reportable use of force incident. And that really tells a story when you think about it. And again, I've come from another agency and certainly been part of large-scale operations. But to have 1 reportable use of force incident is really phenomenal. It just goes and supports why the DPD is a constitutional police agency. But in terms of our crime this year, you know, we're down. We're still trending down. You know, we set a goal at the beginning of the year of a 10% reduction in overall crime, which includes violent and property. And as of this date, we're sitting on a 19% reduction in overall crime. As it relates specifically to violent crime, we're down 9%. In the category of homicide, we're down 14%, which translates into 32 fewer individuals murdered in the city of Detroit. Shootings, we're down 14%, which translates into 123 fewer people shot. But the big news in terms of the steepest reduction, we're seeing a 36% reduction in robbery and a 35% reduction in carjackings, which is a subcategory of the crime of robbery. So, you know, we're trending in the right direction. We're constantly evaluating our strategy, and we're optimistic. We do not want to hit that 300 number that has been common in Detroit for many years. And so we're constantly reevaluating our strategies. We're looking at our gang activity here in the city of Detroit and what we can do further to reduce the incidence of violence.
Chief, the whole issue of excessive police force certainly has been pushed right into the national spotlight with Ferguson, Missouri. And one of the things we have all watched is what seems to be a pretty complete disconnect between police officials there and the people that the police serve. And I'm wondering, as a big city police chief, as you've watched all of this unfold, what have you learned from this?
A better question for me is, what could Ferguson learn from Detroit? I've been very public about being appalled at any comparison of Ferguson to Detroit. And this is certainly not an indictment of the good people who live in Ferguson. But I will tell you that this department is not the Ferguson Police Department. First, if you were just to look at the demographics of the police department, demographics of the city, our city is about 85% or so African American. Our police department's about 65% African American. So in terms of just looking at the race composition of the department and how this police department reflects the community that it serves, not too many departments that can say that. The other part is just our relationship with the community. I've talked a lot about, you know, I work in the neighborhood, the fact that we rolled out months ago our neighborhood police officer initiative and the effect that that's having on building better relationships. And again, going back to what I talked about earlier, when you're talking about homicide clearance rates, we have a community now that has confidence in this police department. we are doing our very best, and we're going to get the job done, and they're communicating with us. In agencies where they have, or cities where they have poor relationships with the police department, there's no conversation. There's no relationship. There's no partnering. You hear a lot about community police partnerships. We have that here in Detroit. We work with our community. In fact, I have an advisory board that I meet with once a month, as an example. So any comparison to Ferguson, maybe a better comparison would be maybe compare a 1967 Detroit Police Department to 2014 Ferguson Police Department, and you might see some similarities in that comparison.
Chief, going forward, knowing that the official end of the federal oversight comes in 2016, how will the public in Detroit and beyond know that the DPD is indeed holding itself accountable going forward?
I first and foremost have talked a lot about accountability coming in the door. I mean, the fact that we're a transparent police agency. You know, we don't hide. You know, I've been very candid about those things that I have found and the things that we have done to correct those issues. I've been here 14 months. Many of the issues that have existed in this police department have gone on for quite a while. I mean, the fact that, you know, there's been an absence of accountability. I mean, we're talking about a department that's been under consent judgment for 11 years. And this is not an indictment of the men and women on the ground who do the work. I've oftentimes said that they wanted to be led. They wanted to have confidence in their leadership, and they're getting that. They wanted to be police officers again. You know, one of the things that I took note of coming in is something that in the industry we call depolicing. And it's common in certain departments that have been under federal oversight, where instead of police officers engaging with the community in terms of enforcing the law, they avoid it because the increased scrutiny of their actions. And so coming in and seeing that the department was in some respects, I'm not saying at all, there was some depolicing, and certainly there were pockets where supervisors were encouraging police officers not to do police work. And so when I heard from police officers advising me, Chief, we want to do police work again, I found that odd. I was actually surprised, and as I began to look further, I could see where, you know, there was some encouragement on the part of supervision, because supervisors felt that they had more paperwork, and it was just too much. That's not the case today. This department is not depolicing. It, in fact, is a law enforcement agency that's getting the job done, which reflected in not only our relationship with the neighborhoods we serve, but our crime statistics.
Detroit Police Chief James Craig speaking on the end of 11 years of federal oversight of Detroit Police that will transition and officially end in 2016. Chief Craig, thank you so much for talking with us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
A small Michigan company has a big goal: to retrofit thousands of vehicles a year to run on propane. Albert Venezio is chairman of ICOM North America, based in New Hudson. Welcome to the program, Albert.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Tell us, what are the pluses of running a car on propane?
When you use propane, and we also call it autogas, that's what's known around the world, you're reducing emissions approximately 50%. You're bringing your particulate matter, which is the black soot that comes out of the tailpipe that causes lung issues, to zero, which is very dramatic. You're using a domestic fuel source. So the United States is the exporter of propane. So that means we have more than enough we can actually export. So we're using 100% U.S. fuel source, and our friends in Canada have lots too. So with the shale play that's going on, there's plenty of propane. And the real thing for the fleets, we're going after the fleet market. Mm-hmm. With the fleets, they're reducing their fuel costs about 30 to 50%. And that's very dramatic, and that can keep people working and companies in business and so forth. So it's a total plus.
Now, I know you have the Metro cars at,
yes,
at Detroit Metropolitan Airport. They're
and
all
in Grand Rapids.
And airport. In Grand Rapids. So
yes,
if someone goes to the airport and sees a Metro car, it's running on a retrofit.
Most all those are running on ICOM systems. There's a few hundred of those, and they save a lot of money every year. They do go through hundreds of thousands of gallons of propane a year. They do about 150 to 200,000 miles a year on those vehicles. So if you consider a consumer vehicle does about 15 to 20,000 miles a year, a fleet vehicle often does 50,000 to 200,000. So one fleet vehicle can equal, say, 10 consumer vehicles. So that's a huge savings. Also, what they're able to do is extend the service life of that vehicle. So propane, what's injected as a liquid, goes in cleaner and it has a cold charge. So that actually extends engine life and as well as the service cycles. So if you change your oil, say, every 3,000 to 4,000 miles with propane, because it's so much cleaner, your oil is cleaner and go to 6,000 to 8,000.
Huh.
So everything is a plus, and it's been that way for many years.
And how do they find engine performance?
equal to or better. So when you inject propane as a liquid, which is one of our patents, we're a patent holder of liquid injection, you have the same or better performance than gasoline, reduced emissions, almost the same miles per gallon in gasoline. It's an all-around win.
Now, what does it take to retrofit a vehicle? Is it an expensive proposition?
Fairly simple, and the return on investment is usually less than a year with most fleets. So what we do is if it's a bi-fuel vehicle, which means you keep your gasoline, so you don't lose your gasoline system. You can use it in you need it for extended range, so forth, and also on startup. We add a propane tank, which is quarter-inch steel. You can shoot a gun at it, and it won't pierce it, so it's very, very safe. We've crash-tested a number of vehicles with the propane tanks. And you add an engine rail system, and it's very simple. It's about, depending on the vehicle and the tank, $6,000 to $8,000 install in most cases. Mm-hmm. And a return on investment with the price of propane when you buy it as auto gas, which is like wholesale propane, you're saving probably somewhere of $1 to $2 a gallon.
And, of course, as we're all listening, we're all thinking now, could this be applied to our individual vehicles? Is that doable?
It could be. And in Europe, for example, there's 23 million propane vehicles around the world. That's the third most after gasoline and diesel. In Europe, when you go to almost any gas station in Italy or Germany or Poland and lesser extent France, you'll see propane right there at the pump. And it's mostly a consumer market. It's not quite a consumer market yet in the U.S., but we think it's coming. As we get more infrastructure out there and more vehicle platforms, EPA certified, which we're the leaders on. We have over 600 EPA certified vehicle platforms. We think it'll then move to the consumer market.
So then we talk practical application, and you hinted at the infrastructure. So
right
now, not very great. You'd have to go where to get your auto gas?
Yeah, great point, Cindy. So right now, it's basically a fleet market. So we would work with a propane partner, say an AmeriGas, Ferrogas, Suburban Propane, Independent, and they would bring a propane station and put it in at the site of the fleet. So they'll build a station. So instead of going to the gasoline station and paying, say, $3.89 a gallon, they might pay $2 or some number like $2 a gallon at their own site. And that station is a very inexpensive station. It's very simple to use. There's not a great cost like there is with natural gas stations. As this is becoming more and more prevalent in the USA, like it is in many parts around the world, you'll start to see it more and more in public stations. And I think there's over 1,000 right now in the U.S. that are public stations.
And with the tank you put in, Albert, how many miles can you get out of it?
Usually it equals the same on the gasoline. So say your gasoline tank range is 300 miles, we'll find usually equal to or a little bit more. So actually double your range in most cases.
Now, I remember some years ago doing consumer alert reports for TV that focused on the dangers of propane grills. And I talked with firefighters who've put out big house fires that began because of a propane tank fire. So talk to us about how safe it is to be driving with a propane tank.
Sure. Great question. So propane is actually much safer than gasoline. The flammability range is a limited range where gasoline is, once you reach a certain temperature, it can be explosive. With propane, it's a very limited range, and you're a quarter inch thick steel tank. With a gasoline tank, it's a plastic tank you could actually punch through. So there's also many safety features on the system in accordance with NFP 58, which is National Fire Protection 58. So for example, an accident happens and a hose gets severed on the system, a double back check valve will slam shut when it feels the pressure go down and there's no incidents. We've had over 12,000 systems in the U.S. market, a couple hundred thousand systems worldwide, and ICOM in Europe has made over 4 million propane vehicle tanks, and we've never had an accident that hurt anyone.
Okay.
So we're very prevalent in the school bus market. We manage a lot of systems for school buses. We have to crash test those vehicles, and we know how important those kids are, and we meet the school bus requirements. So that's how safe propane is, much safer than gasoline.
Well, we know propane's a domestic fuel, Albert, and it gives us a good viable alternative to foreign oil. But a lot of the propane we get comes from fracking, and you and I know fracking is highly controversial. So how do you respond to these critics who worry about all the water that's used and the potential harm from the chemicals used during extracting and processing?
There's some concerns there, and I think it has to be studied further. Not all propane comes from fracking. We've had propane for over 100 years before they're actually fracking. It's just when they do a well and they go for natural gas, they go for a wet well where there's natural gas, propane, and butane. So as there's more fracking, there's more propane, but we don't have to have fracking to have propane. And there's definitely some concerns there, and there's concerns with the oil wells, as we saw from what happened in the Gulf. So anytime you're going into the earth, there's always some concerns. But we need energy, and it's better than bringing in from the Middle East or so forth.
Do you see propane as an end unto itself, or do you think this is a bridge until
engineers can improve the battery or develop an engine using hydrogen so we can ultimately one day walk away from petroleum fuels?
Yeah, great question. It's definitely a bridge fuel like natural gas is. And keep in mind that propane is a natural gas solid, so it's basically kind of like a derivative of natural gas. I believe it's a bridge fuel, but I think that bridge is 10 to 15 to 20 years. So I don't really believe in an alternative fuel is over 20 years personally. And I did natural gas vehicles. I've done ammonia vehicles and a variety of vehicles. At the moment, there is no silver bullet. Definitely electric is not a silver bullet. It fits certain applications, but you're not going to get a 26,000 gross vehicle weight vehicle to run on electric efficiently. So I think we can get many millions of vehicles, especially high mileage fleet vehicles, on propane that will displace many millions of gallons of diesel or gasoline. At the moment, there's no silver bullet, Cindy, but we're an important part of that arsenal to go after, or that menu, natural gas, propane, electric, and so forth.
How long do you think, honestly, it might take before we in the U.S. might be where Europe is, where it is part of, one sitting in someone's driveway?
Great question. Gasoline is about $10 a gallon in most of Europe, where propane at the pump is about $3.50 to $4 a gallon. We don't have that quite a disparity here. We have more or less $2.25 to maybe $3.80, say. So it's a nice disparity, and the fleets can take advantage of that, but it's not a 3-to-1 or 2.5-to-1 ratio like in Europe. So there might be some time. There's many grants and incentives by states and the federal government to get alternative fuel vehicles out there, which usually translates to natural gas and propane. They're the ones that are practical in the fleet applications. We've won many grants with our partners. So that gets the vehicles out there and it gets the fleet started. And once they see all the benefits and how easy it is to use and it runs equal to or better in gasoline, they start to expand. I think it's a while. My personal opinion is 5 years or so before we're quite like Europe in the millions and millions of vehicles, but we're definitely on the right track. To give you an example, we did the same amount of business in the second week of June of 2014 that we did in 2013, and we had a very good year in 2013. So we'll probably do 2 or 2.5 times the sales we did in 2013, and that's indicative of the industry right now.
How many vehicles do you have on the road right now?
Over 12,000 in USA and over 250,000 worldwide. And that's with fleets such as DHL, UPS, Menards, MetroCars. You know, these are all very recognized brands that use hundreds, if not thousands, of systems.
Albert Venizio is the North American chairman of ICOM North America, based in New Hudson, and his company retrofits vehicles to run on propane. Albert, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Cindy. Pleasure being here.
Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our director today was Allie Billings. Our engineer was Bob Scon. Contributors are Mike Blank, Michelle Hahn, and Annie Norris. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.